Blind Nil Audio.
Greetings, Carl here. Imagine it's a very still day, and you're on a boat in the ocean. There's no wind, no swell. The water is flat as a mirror. The calm goes on just long enough for you to start to feel like it's normal. Then a small wave finally comes, and it feels big. Then a regular wave comes, and it feels huge. As scary as it might feel, it's important to remember that waves are normal. In fact, occasional storms are normal. And the last thing you want to do when you get into a storm is abandon ship. But what if the storms just keep coming? How long do you stick with the ship if you end up weathering one storm just to see maybe even a bigger one on the horizon? Joining me on the show today is Dave Gesch. And as a writer and co-executive producer for television comedies like The Big Bang Theory and Third Rock from the Sun, he's weathered storms on a fairly regular basis throughout his career. And even though the financial rewards for success in television can be significant, you learn over time that to survive, you need to learn how to foster what I call general resilience, which is a gentler way to describe an emergency fund, not just for financial well-being, but emotional and mental as well. Because it turns out that a long career in Hollywood is almost always defined by uncertainty. Just ask Dave. And so today, I'll do just that. I'm Carl Richards, an author, artist, and a financial planner. And today we're talking about money with Dave Gesch. This is 50 Fires, a podcast about money and meaning. So I have a question about working hard. As I was preparing for this, I was reviewing your bio and all that you've done. And then I got to the point of getting a little bit of insight into all that you're still doing. There's like five full-time jobs in here. So what's that all about?
Diversification.
Well, talk to me about that. Why are you still putting in that kind of, I don't know about hours, but that kind of effort?
Well, as a writer and storyteller, I'm so interested in talking to people, finding out stories. Everybody's got an interesting story and the connection. The amazing thing about being a TV writer, a comedy writer, is how collaborative it is. And I don't think I could ever write a novel by myself. I think I'd lose confidence in the idea way too fast. I doubt myself. And so I think all those different projects come from a place of passion. Like, oh my God, wouldn't that be great? But the other thing is the diversification, which is I don't know where that next thing is going to come from. And I really want to work on more projects with more talented people. And I don't know what to do except to put more chips on the table.
So all of that was about, I have an idea, I want to, you know, like passion, the enthusiasm, working with other people. And then there was tidbits about diversification. I'm curious, is the creative, the love of the creative act driving, or is there still some fear? Because you're not going to get out of this question. So I'm really curious.
I'm still very motivated to make money. I see the value in that. And if there is a project that has a potential upside, I'm really drawn to that. Doesn't mean it's the only thing, but...
Let me ask you real quick. Sorry to interrupt, but why are you still motivated to make money?
You know, I am embarrassed to say that it still is one of those measures of success for me. You know, I remember when I thought about being a writer in Hollywood, I just thought, wow, They actually tell you every week how you did. Here are your ratings. Mm. Here's how your show did compared to everybody else. Here's how much money your movie made. And people can argue all about whether or not that show was good or not good, or should have won the award or should not have won the award. But you can't argue about how many people saw that. And for me, as somebody who spent their life being very motivated to achieve things, I loved that simplicity. And being able to work on a popular show like The Rock from the Sun or Big Bang Theory was really thrilling. That really gave me an enormous thrill, like serotonin dump.
Because of the money or because of the creative act and the collaboration that you pointed to?
I think the thing, somebody once said, you can't be successful in TV and not make money. Mm. It's just a byproduct of it. So it's one of those things where you can be entirely focused on the creative output. The goal is to make the funniest show with the characters that the most people fall in love with, and work with writers and collectively share pieces of you and make something that you're proud of, that your grandparents can watch at home, and pour your heart into it, right? 100%. And if you succeed, you'll make a lot of money. When I think I was right, 25, and I was a staff writer on Third Rock from the Sun, and my agents, my partners and I sold a movie to DreamWorks. And I remember my cut of it was $30,000. And I got this check, and I already had a job, like to pay my bills, pay more than my bills. And I remember thinking, like, what do I do with this? No one ever told me what to do with it. Even though I took economics.
Like, what you mean, just what to do with extra?
Yeah, with extra. I knew not to spend it, but I didn't know how to invest it.
Was that the first time, like in your career, where you got a large sum of money that was above and beyond like the normal paycheck?
Yeah, for sure. Because when you start as a TV writer, you get your weekly. You're actually hired week to week. So it's awesome. But you also haven't worked ever, and you still have college loans, and you know, that money gets spent. And so, yeah, this was this thing that I knew I was supposed to do something with it. And I just didn't know what it was. You know, I didn't understand anything about investing, despite having read so much about it and reading the business page every day. And a couple of years later, you know, my girlfriend and I at the time dressed up as the Asian financial crisis, you know, like that was our Halloween costume. And she's Chinese American. And so she represented the currencies of Asia, and I was like the Western currencies. And I mean, that's a weird costume for somebody who has so much anxiety about investing. But I think if you think about it, why would your costume be a financial crisis? Because I was caught up in that catastrophizing.
Yeah. Catastrophizing and anxious. Where does that come from, the anxiousness and the catastrophizing around money?
So one thing, after being in therapy for like 15 years or something, it just popped into my head. In first grade, I was playing with a friend, and I was chasing them, and it was spring. So where we grew up, you'd have a screen door, but you put a glass winter storm window in to keep in the heat. And so the door was open and it was closing, and I was running, and I slipped on the rug, and I put my hand through that single pane glass door, and I cut my artery in my arm and I cut my chest, and I it was crazy, and I almost died, and I had surgery, and I can't make this finger, like this nerve never grew back, you know? So I could never do this is a bad thing at Big Bang Theory, is I could only do the Star Trek Vulcan salute with one hand, like this one never worked. So, you know, in an instant, my life changed when I was 8. And looking back, I was like, oh, that must have had an effect on me. That must have contributed a little bit to, hey, your life could change in an instant. Something bad could happen very fast. And so money, I think, just became one of those things that could be bad. as opposed to why don't you be optimistic and think about what could happen, I would always go to the, you know, if you're thinking of the range of outcomes, I was always in the negative range of outcomes. There have been moments where in eighth grade, I was so nervous about getting into college that I got everyone in my eighth grade class to sign a petition saying we should have Latin in high school so that we can study it, so that we can do well on the SATs.
Come on.
And so years later, Wes Anderson makes Rushmore. And there's a scene in that movie where the protagonist gets kicked out of private school and goes to public school, and he has a petition to get everyone to have Latin in school.
Stop it.
And it blew my mind when I saw that. So I was such an anxious kid, right? Like I was like, even in eighth grade, I got to get into a good college. And it wasn't pressure from my parents. It was pressure I put on myself. And so what happened is I was so impatient. I applied to boarding school and I got a scholarship to go to boarding school, but there was still tuition to pay. And my dad took an extra job as a chauffeur driving people. We lived in Connecticut and driving people to JFK. And so that to me was an incredible gesture of obviously just like support, but also that you just work more.
Work more. So I am sort of curious what money was like. Specifically, what did your parents teach you, if anything, about money?
So I have awesome parents who gave me everything. And I'm going to get emotional. But my dad was a high school English teacher, and my mom taught, tutored at the junior high, worked with special ed kids, worked at an insurance agency, worked a bunch of different jobs. And so we always had enough, but we didn't have much left over. So they taught me the value of hard work. They taught me the value of sacrifice. The town I grew up in, Connecticut, a lot of people worked, had great union jobs at Electric Boat, building submarines. They worked at the Coast Guard Academy. They worked at the Navy base. And so I felt like everybody had about the same, you know, except for a few of my friends whose parents were lawyers or something, or doctors. So I was in this world of relative sameness. And then, but then I would see things and be like, oh, wow, okay, that's different. And then when I did go to boarding school, there were some crazy rich people like I'd never, ever, ever seen, including the son of the Aga Khan, who, you know, if you Google him, the story was he asked his roommate, what are you doing for spring break? And the roommate was like, I don't know. And he's like, well, my dad's renting a bunch of yachts and we're going to go watch the America's Cup in Australia. Would you think you'd like to come? And his roommate said, I have to ask my mom. And so there was like this other, I remember hanging out in the dorm and people were saying, you know, hey, where are you from? What do you do? What's your dad do? And I was like, my dad's a high school English teacher. What does your dad do? And this one guy goes, you know, the Discover card? And I was like, yeah, the credit card, the Discover card. My dad started that. And I thought, how do you start a credit card? You know, so they were like, I was introduced at a young age to some crazy extremes. And that, I mean, that right. definitely had an impact
right.
on me.
Right, right. So eighth grade, you mentioned we always had enough. There wasn't much left over. How did you know that? How did you know you always had enough?
You know, my dad's the oldest of four brothers, and one was a very successful businessman, and one was a lawyer, and one was a doctor. And so I saw more. I saw what vacations and bigger houses and like those things, like it was subtle, but it was probably there in the background impacting me. And there was some, I mean, remember being in the 80s and I think we went to a funeral or something, and my uncle was a lawyer and he had a Saab, which is really cool. And then he had a phone and he like made a phone call with that big phone that was installed between the front seats. And then I think I remember him saying, you know, well, this is a business and so I can lease it back to the business. And then, you know, when the lease is up, I can buy it for a dollar, which is the kind of thing, you know, like a financial advisor would tell you, or business thing, or whatever. But I had never heard anything like that. You know, like there's no tax planning when your parents are teachers, right? There's income and there's taxes and maybe you get some back or maybe you owe some, but that's it. And so there'd be like these little things that would introduce me to this other world. And I remember thinking like, I'm very interested in that world.
Right, for sure.
And so I find continuing to make money a source of safety and calm. Hmm. And it is still tied up in my self-worth, which I've worked hard to not be so achievement oriented, but there's part of me that's never going to go away.
We'll be right back with more from 50 Fires.
Hey, it's Carl. You know what's hard for most of us? Talking money. That's what I'm talking about. Talking about money is hard for most of us, but there's somebody who it is not hard for. She's been doing it forever. Her name is Shauna Game. And if you've been enjoying the conversations I am having here at 50 Fires, I think you would love what Shauna's got going on at her podcast. The podcast is called Everyone's Talking Money. And just like 50 Fires, Shauna's goal with Everyone's Talking Money is to go beyond the spreadsheets and the calculators and the budgeting apps to talk about how our emotional relationship with money impacts our lives. With over 900 episodes, that's right, 900, there is an episode for any and every practical money question you have. Some of Shauna's recent episodes include retirement risks to avoid and credit card versus debit card. Which one should I use? You're going to love it. Subscribe to Everyone's Talking Money on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to 50 Fires. So interesting to me how hard it is for us to, I was just thinking about this Pema Chodron quote, which I'd love to just read real quick and have you respond to, When Things Fall Apart.
I love that book.
Yeah, I listen to it twice a year on Audible. I just listen to a chapter because they're like 12 to 15 minutes before I go on a run or a mountain bike ride. And then I just let it bounce around in my head. But there's this quote. She says this: "We long to have some reliable, comfortable ground under our feet. But we've tried 1,000 ways to hide and 1,000 ways to tie up all the loose ends. And the ground just keeps moving." Like, what's been your experience? Because you chose to move to some place and build a career that would be hard. I mean, you'd be hard pressed to find something more uncertain. Like, talk about that struggle and that Pema quote.
So I moved to LA in January of 94. The Malibu fires had happened the year before. The Rodney King riots were in everyone's memory. And I had been a couple days there sleeping on my friend's couch in Long Beach when the Northridge earthquake happened. So talk about this, you know, just that quote, the ground you stand on, right? Never been an earthquake. And my friend worked for the LA Times and she ran out. She goes, "You okay?" I said, "I'm okay." She goes, "I got to go to work." And she just left me. And I thought to myself, what the hell have I just done? I've just moved to Los Angeles to try to be a sitcom writer. And the answer is I just didn't understand how risky it was going to be. I didn't understand the uncertainty. I didn't. If somebody had sat me down and explained the odds of getting a job and the odds of making enough money to someday buy a house and the odds of this and the odds of that, I don't know if I would have done it or maybe I would have said, well, I'll try it for a while and I could always do something else. And so it helped to be dumb, you know, despite being anxious. I was.
You were pretty dumb.
Yeah. I like one side of the brain wasn't connecting with the other side of the brain or whatever. Right. It was really helpful. And so I think for me, I was able to focus on this idea of like, this was a project that we could work hard to do. And I met this awesome guy out here who became my writing partner for years, Jason Van Oker. And he had that same ethos. And one day he said, I don't want a girlfriend. I want an agent. And it was like that focus at the time, I guess because we were in our 20s, like it was okay, you know, but it's not sustainable. And it's not particularly healthy. You know, you can sprint in your 20s. You can hold your breath for a really long time. You can just push. But then at a certain point, I had to find some other way. And that also, I had kids really late in life. My oldest was born on my 40th birthday. Hmm. And having kids changes what you care about, the problems you have. And so a bunch of those things all kind of came together and came to a breaking point. And I just had to figure out a different way to live.
Do you wish somebody would have sat you down and told you about the odds?
I couldn't imagine, and I try to remind myself when I talk to young people, in my early 20s, I could not imagine what it was like to be in your 30s or 40s or 50s. I was so focused in the short term. I remember being in college and going to a party. I was talking to this woman. She was a grad student. She was 25. I was like, whoa.
So old.
Whoa. She has like, she's 25. That's crazy. And so I knew a lot of things, but I was incredibly naive and I didn't have a good system. I didn't have a philosophy. I didn't have this kind of like, you know, identify a goal and work towards it is a plan, but it's not exactly a philosophy. It's entirely achievement oriented. When you don't attain those achievements, it's devastating and it can burn you up. It can burn you out really fast. So that all goes towards this thing that I've tried to figure out a little bit more and why I love that Pema Chodron quote.
This all goes towards the thing I've tried to figure out a little bit more. What thing are you talking about?
I think it's like a philosophy. It's almost like a protocol. Okay, let's start and just admit how much uncertainty there is in the world, right? So when a strike happens, there's a strike. We understand there's uncertainty about the strike. We don't know how long that's going to last. We have the anxiety about not being able to make any money and have any meetings, but then maybe we have the opportunity. What can we do during this time? I tell all the young writers I meet, go out on the strike line. You're going to meet showrunners. You're going to get great advice. It's maybe the best thing that ever happens to you in your career. You know, if you can just meet more people, don't check the internet all the time to read every article about what's happening with the strike. Tune out the noise. And then stick to it and let the compounding happen. Once you have this system, then you can be moving forward so that hopefully you can find success, but with a little bit more flexibility than certainly what I used to have.
The last strike was in 2007.
It was 2007 to 2008. It was 100 days. And I was in the first season of The Big Bang Theory. We'd shot maybe 6 or 7 episodes, and I hadn't worked on a show in a long time. And I thought, oh man, this is it. These guys are great. These actors are awesome. This show could be a hit. And it premiered and the ratings were okay. And then it was like, what? There's a strike. Like we can't, I finally got a job and now we can't do it. And so we at least got through it and then could immediately go back to work. And that was an incredibly stressful strike because I had much less savings. There's a much smaller cushion. And I was really trying to will myself to make the strike end. It was just so dumb. It was a terrible use of my resources. I was obsessively reading the news, inadvertently just devoting so much energy to worrying. And that was a terrible use of my energy in retrospect. And this time, at least I understand that nothing I do is going to change the outcome, and I'm going to have to deal with what the outcome is. So I'm just focused on those basic things, control what you can control, and focus on the stuff that you can have an impact on.
How did you learn that? The different, I mean, I'm just sort of struck by the difference between, you know, the last experience and this experience. You just said I tried to will it to stop, and this is much different for a couple of reasons. One being there's some cushion, but there's also a fundamentally different way of approaching it. How did you learn that, to let go a bit?
So 2007-2008 was probably my peak stress, because I had been working in TV for over 15 years, and I'd had a retirement account built up, and I hadn't invested any of it. I was in all cash. And I thought that that was really because, you know, I didn't trust who was going to invest my money. And I just, you know, had a very catastrophic view of things, like the world was going to end financially. And I read this book, The Investment Answer, which talked about this different way of investing. And then that opened up this world of having a plan that included a range of outcomes. It's so simple, but I had always spent my life thinking, what's the one thing, and you got to get it. And then if you don't, then you do that thing. It was so linear, as opposed to here's the Monte Carlo simulation of the jobs in TV you'll get, the outcomes in your marriage, the kinds of children that you will have. And that just opened up a whole world of possibility. It allowed me to just think differently, like reframe what the questions are that I was trying to ask and answer. And so now, by the time the strike happens, I can look and say, oh, I fundamentally understand the role of uncertainty in life. And I used to think that uncertainty only created anxiety. For the first 35 years of my life, it did. But it also creates opportunity.
Yeah. It's so interesting. I've had these conversations with people in every different sort of industry. And it's interesting because I gravitate towards just what I would generally refer to as artists, including people who build businesses that way. It's like, I almost wish there was a way to test. The literature calls this tolerance for ambiguity. You know, I almost wish there was a way to like stick your finger in and just be told like, no, go be an accountant.
Right.
Not to pick on accountants, but you know, like your tolerance for ambiguity is not, this isn't a good idea for you. And I've generally been referring to all these people as people who take risk for a living, whether that's art or you happen to call it a business or you happen to call it a TV show. It's all sort of the same thing. And this idea of building general resilience, because you can't build event specific resilience because you don't know what the event will be. So there's a difference between event specific resilience and general resilience. The idea of, you know, you pointed to having some money in the savings account, but there's also like personal resilience, like you've had to do. How do I learn to not just fix everything with harder work? You know, and how do I learn how to let go of the stuff I can't control? And that all of those are pointing to me to the same concept of like, how do I become generally more resilient so I can live in reality, and reality is uncertain. Like I can keep playing this little fantasy game if I want, that I can control things and then I can keep being disappointed, or I can, you know, do reality-based planning, not fantasy-based planning.
And it's so heartbreaking to work unbelievably hard and the thing doesn't work. And so in 2003, 2004, my partners and I made this animated show. It was the first CG network show. And it, because it was CG, it took forever to make. And I just worked so hard. It was the first show that was going to get on the air. And the CG wasn't great. And it was canceled after four episodes and nobody's ever seen it. And so the disappointment of that was so devastating, because I knew I had worked the hardest I possibly could, and I didn't have a plan for after that. You know, it was just like all in.
Mm-hmm.
And I compare that with when my show United States of Al got canceled 2 years ago, and my partner was like, hey, you've been working all the time on this show. You've been talking about getting married. What if we just go get married in your sister's backyard in 2 months? And I was like, yeah, that sounds like a great idea. That's a great plan. And there's an opportunity, you know, that it was like 2003, just anxiety. And then today, the opportunity and that anxiety. And that's like the difference for me. And I try to tell, I had taught at USC for a long time, and I just try to tell these students, which is like, it really is chances at bat. Everything's not going to work out. Your first movie's not going to work. It's even, I was teaching this webisodes class, and I would say, you know, try to figure out a way to make one episode a week, even if it's like 1 minute, if it's whatever, and just do it and work on it and get better at it. And it might be the 30th episode's the really best one. And that's the first one you show somebody. You know, you just, you have to find that process. In the process is what people should focus on, because the outcome has so much luck. And Ted Lasso is a show that everybody loves and it's great. I don't know if it would have been as successful if it hadn't come out during the pandemic. Not to take anything away from that show, but it's like there's just luck that's required in so much of this, what you're talking about, like working and dealing with risk. Mm-hmm. There's so much uncertainty, it's outside of your control.
That idea of working so hard on something that then doesn't work. Like, it's such a cute little thing to say to yourself, like, I'm going to take risk. I'm going to do things that may not work. I'm going to work really hard. It's like a cute story. At least I find myself calling it, referring to myself. Like, that's a cute story you've told yourself, Carl, that you like to take risk until it doesn't work. And then when it doesn't work, you use the word devastating, which is so interesting. And do you think you've removed fear from the driver's seat and now it really is more about the money is just a byproduct of this thing I happen to love to do? Or is there still something, hey, I'm a little worried about it, that's why I'm just going to continue to grind?
So that's a great question to think about for the next 6 months. But what I'd say is I used to be so worried about the future bad thing, that I would never make money again, that I would never work on another show, that I would never do that thing. And now I'm a little better at being focused in the present and feeling, okay, I feel good now and I feel good about the things that could happen in the future. But I also know that there are bad things that could happen in the future. And so fear would be a natural thing to come later. It's, you know, it's like, I don't think I really believe people who say, you know, I figured this out, you know, the going forward, you figured it out.
Dave, just to wrap up, let's pretend like it's 20 years from now and I'm still doing this show. And your youngest daughter, her name's Mimi?
Mimi, yeah. Mimi. She's 10.
And she's 10. Let's say it's 30 years from now, because so she's 40. And we're talking about money and meaning and, you know, what money means to her and the role it plays in her life. You're listening to it. What would you hope that you would hear her say?
I hope that she knows that money's a thing that you should talk about. And it is nothing to be ashamed of. It's a tool, and you can't chase it for its own sake. I hope that she is living her life unencumbered by whatever legacy I had. That I know there's some comedy writers whose kids have said, I don't want to do what you do, Mom. You work too hard. And there's the story of one comedy writer who picked up her kid at school. And the teacher said, there was a keyboard over in the play area. And the girl was just saying, she was typing and saying, not now, I'm working. And so I think you always worry about, despite your best intentions, just as when you write something and putting it out to the world, you don't know exactly how it's going to be interpreted. And that's true of every single decision as a parent that you give to your kids. You don't know what they're going to remember, that awesome vacation you took with mom that they have no memory of. So I just hope that they can make their own informed choices and have their own version of a philosophy, an approach towards life. And it's not going to be mine. And they may not have figured it out by the time they're 30 or 40. But I hope that they seek it out and try to figure it out, because the alternative is really stressful. And not only can it help their lives, if they talk about it, it has the impact to possibly help a lot of other people's lives too.
Listening to Dave's story, I kept thinking about this idea of how crazy it was that a kid that wanted certainty so badly chose such an uncertain career. Hollywood's the last place where you should expect to have certainty. And yet, he figured out a way to manage it all. And that's all any of us are trying to do. We're just trying to see the opportunity in the uncertainty instead of getting swallowed up by the fear. We're just trying to learn how to surf reality. And building up general resilience, the only way I know how to do it is one uncertain step at a time. So let's do it together. Until next time, cheers, my friends. 50 Fires is a production of Blind Nil Audio in association with The Roost. If you find this show valuable, and I sure hope you do, please share it with a friend and leave a 6 or 7 or maybe even 8-star review over on Apple Podcasts. It's crazy how much that helps the show get introduced to more people. Speaking of more people, I have a goal that we can use 50 Fires as a spark to start 1 million conversations a month about money. I've heard from so many of you about the conversations you're having around the dinner table, on a road trip in the car, or at your favorite coffee shop, and I think we need more. So if you've got a friend or a family member that you think would benefit from having a conversation about money, or if you happen to give advice for a living, we've created a whole set of free resources. Think of it as a book club about money. It's over at 50fires.com, and you can use it every week. We're updating it every week so that you can help me start 1 million conversations a month about money. I'm looking forward to our next conversation around the fire. Cheers, my friends.
The views, information, or opinions expressed in this series are solely those of the individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of Chip and Joanna Gaines, Blind Nil Audio, nor Magnolia.